Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 15th of June, these are our main stories. The US Supreme Court lifts Donald Trump's ban on bump stocks, a gun accessory used in America's deadliest mass shooting. Western leaders at the G7 summit reject Russia's proposal for a ceasefire based on Ukraine surrendering four regions in the east. And Barclays suspends its sponsorship of UK music festivals after bands start to boycott them over their links to Israel. Also in this podcast...
It can keep the mouse moving for as long as it's needed. Always jiggle responsibly is the key messaging.
The popularity of mouse jigglers and how one firm is cracking down on workers using them. And why grey whales are shrinking. There's been a setback for Americans calling for more gun control. The US Supreme Court has struck down a ban on a gun accessory called a bump stock that enables semi-automatic rifles to fire more quickly, 6 bullets a second. They were banned by Donald Trump after one of the most deadly shootings in US history, but the court ruled it was unconstitutional. My colleague Paul Moss spoke to our correspondent in Washington, Nomia Iqbal.
This ban on bump stocks was actually enacted back in 2018, and that was a year after 60 people were killed at a Las Vegas music festival. It was one of the deadliest mass shootings in US modern history. More than 800 were injured, and the gunman in that incident used a bump stock to fire more than 1,000 rounds of ammunition. And so this was a policy, this was a decision that was brought in by the Trump administration. It was actually a major decision in recent years to address the nation's gun violence problem. It is worth adding that this ruling does not mean that they will suddenly be readily available nationwide. There are up to 18 states that have already banned them.
I think a lot of people listening will be surprised at the idea that a court would rule it was okay for people to own something which is effectively like a machine gun. What were the arguments used in court to say it was a good idea?
Well, it was actually split down ideological lines. So it was a vote of 6-3, and the conservative majority found that basically Donald Trump's administration exceeded its power with the ban. They interpreted a decades-old law. They said that a firearm with this accessory did not meet the definition of a machine gun under federal law. And just to quote to you Justice Clarence Thomas, who wrote the opinion, he said, "Nothing changes when a semi-automatic rifle is equipped with a bump stock. The firing cycle remains the same." He said all that a bump stock merely does is reduce the amount of time that elapses between separate functions of the trigger. That was totally rejected by the liberal justices, and Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who's one of them, she wrote a dissenting opinion which she read from the bench, which is pretty rare. And she said, just to quote her, "The court puts bump stocks back in civilian hands, and that this majority opinion would have deadly consequences." And in reference to this idea that bump stocks don't turn semi-automatic weapons into machine guns, she said, to quote, "When I see a bird that walks like a duck, swims like a duck, and quacks like a duck, I call that bird a duck."
I know that there is an ongoing, for many decades, battle legally over gun control in the United States. Is this result part of a trend? I mean, are we seeing a loosening of the laws around gun control in general?
Gun policies and plans to try and tighten up gun laws have been stalling in Congress for some time now. What was interesting with this ruling is that Donald Trump welcomed it, which would be considered odd considering it was his policy. But he is in presidential campaign mode. Being pro-Second Amendment rights and pro-gun rights is a very Republican position. President Biden's also in campaign mode. He really came out and criticized this ruling, saying that, to quote him, "weapons of war have no place on American streets." He lashed out at Donald Trump. He said that he and his Supreme Court nominees, in reference to the fact that three justices on the bench were appointed by the former president, do not care about the American people. I mean, politically, President Biden wants to push for more strict gun laws. He wants assault-style or military-grade weapons, ammunition, and screening process expanded for who can and cannot have a gun. He just wants it to get stricter.
Nomia Iqbal in Washington. At the G7 summit in Italy, the official agenda was dominated by migration and China's trade policies. But there's been much talk about a speech by President Putin that he'd call an immediate ceasefire in Ukraine if certain conditions were met. They were that Ukraine would give up four regions in the east, partially occupied by Russia now, and abandon ambitions to join NATO. Western leaders dismissed the offer as a demand for Ukraine to capitulate, with Kiev calling the proposals offensive to common sense. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale reports from the summit in southern Italy.
The war between Russia and Ukraine is being fought on three fronts. The fighting on the ground, the industrial race to manufacture ammunition, and the diplomatic battle for global opinion. And it's this latter contest that's being played out between G7 leaders and Vladimir Putin. The G7 are agreeing military pacts with Ukraine, promising more air defences, using frozen Russian assets to loan Kiev $50 billion. Their message is the West is united and unflagging in its support. President Putin's response is to offer a ceasefire and peace talks, just so long as Ukraine gives up four huge regions in the east, Donetsk, Kherson, Luhansk and Zaporizhia, and abandons its ambitions to join NATO. Today we're making a concrete, real peace proposal, Mr. Putin told Russian diplomats. If Kiev and Western capitals reject it in the same way as before, then they take political and moral responsibility for continuing the bloodshed. Kiev did indeed swiftly reject the proposal. President Zelensky said it was the kind of ultimatum Hitler made and could not be trusted. Some analysts said Mr. Putin was trying to preempt a conference in Switzerland this weekend where 90 world leaders will discuss Ukraine's own ideas for peace. Others said Russia's leader was trying to divide the West and appeal to the global South, playing the peacemaker to encourage countries to push for an end to the war. But the US Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Mr. Putin was in no position to dictate peace terms. And NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said Mr. Putin's proposal was not for peace, but more aggression and occupation.
Russia began its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. But Oleksandr Matviychuk, the founder of the Center of Civil Liberties, has been monitoring the way Russia uses information and disinformation and anti-Ukrainian messages for many years. Babita Sharma reports now on how disinformation is a big part of the war in Ukraine.
Russians came to kill us, so it's have a very direct impact for several years before large-scale war. Russia used information like a weapon of mass destruction.
Oleksandra stayed in her home city of Kyiv throughout the war, documenting evidence of alleged war crimes committed in her country since 2014. One of the worst of these happened in Bucha, a suburb of the capital Kyiv, occupied by Russian troops in March 2022. More than 400 people were killed there. Evidence came from on-the-ground reporters and was also verified using satellite imagery. Yet the facts were disputed by Russia.
What happened in Bucha is exactly a false flag attack by the Kyiv regime and its Western sponsors. The possible goal of this provocation is horrifying and brings back the nightmares of the Nazi crimes during the Second World War.
That was Russian ambassador Vasily Nebenzia, claiming that the images coming from Bucha were faked. It's part of the Russian narrative to justify its aggression. The message? Ukraine is a hostile neighbour, armed by the West and guided by fascist ideology. Anastasia Romaniuk is just one of Ukraine's army of young fact-checkers.
The funny thing was that they very quickly released several contradictory versions of what happened in Bucha. And in the same time, they were trying to push first the narrative that the Ukrainian army killed those people. And simultaneously, they were trying to push the narrative that this massacre never happened.
Olga Robinson works with BBC Verify, the BBC's fact-checking service, and has been monitoring the Russian disinformation ecosystem throughout the conflict in Ukraine.
It was quite easy to debunk that narrative because we were able to use satellite imagery from the area to then compare where the bodies were lying. And we were able to establish fairly quickly that the bodies were actually visible literally from space way before the Russian troops withdrew. The whole narrative fell apart. They try to tap into existing frustrations, existing kind of negative attitudes towards, say, Western countries or former colonial powers, and essentially feed into already some of the notions that exist in the society and kind of try to amplify them further. But I think also what is important to understand about Russian disinformation in particular is that sometimes what they're trying to do is to confuse you as a reader, to make you doubt everything, to make you doubt the very concept of truth, whether it actually exists or not.
Supporting Ukraine's war efforts with weapons and money has become hugely divisive, and it's something that Russia is exploiting. Lisa Kaplan is the founder and CEO of Alethea, an American technology company helping organizations protect themselves from disinformation and social media manipulation.
The way that we see it playing out in the United States is that the Russian government, which used to try to sow chaos by amplifying narratives on both sides of the political spectrum, is now laser focused on amplifying narratives and supporting candidates that advocate for protectionist, more isolationist policies, while denigrating candidates, including the current Biden administration in the United States, for wanting to support Ukraine.
And for our Nobel laureate, Oleksandra Matveichuk, what advice would she give to those who feel overloaded and overwhelmed by information?
Probably I will say that truths exist. And sometimes it's very important to go deeper and to use the simple criteria to analyze the source, to analyze the experts who tell some things, not to be manipulated by people with money or people with informational resources who try to use our vulnerability for their own goals.
That was the human rights defender Oleksandra Matveichuk. To hear other Nobel Prize laureates explaining how disinformation is undermining their work, search for BBC documentary Who's Truth wherever you get your BBC podcasts. South Africa's parliament has re-elected Cyril Ramaphosa as president after a landmark coalition deal.
Honourable MC Ramaphosa, 283 votes. I accordingly declare Honourable MC Ramaphosa duly elected president.
Ramaphosa!
The sound of parliamentarians celebrating his re-election after a period of political drama. The country is now set to have a government of national unity with a deal between the African National Congress and the Democratic Alliance. This comes after the ANC lost its overall majority for the first time in 30 years. Our Africa correspondent Barbara Pettusher is in Cape Town.
Cyril Ramaphosa played a key role in the negotiations that brought an end to apartheid 30 years ago. He will now steer South Africa through a seismic shift in its politics. He won his second term backed by the ANC's longtime opponent, the Democratic Alliance. Shortly before the vote, they agreed on a power-sharing arrangement that also brings in other smaller parties. The Democratic Alliance has a reputation for representing the interests of the white minority, which it denies. Its free market agenda also clashes with the ANC's social welfare policies. But ANC leaders said this arrangement was the best one to ensure stability. The next step is for Mr. Ramaphosa to allocate cabinet positions, which will include members of the Democratic Alliance. The multi-party deal does not include two ANC breakaway parties, and they will probably benefit if it fails to deliver economic improvements demanded by voters. But polls show many South Africans want this unprecedented grand coalition to succeed.
We turn to China now, where a prominent women's rights activist who's reported on the Me Too movement has been handed a 5-year prison sentence for subversion. Krupa Padhi found out more from our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton.
But this woman, Sophia Huang, or Huang Xueqin, as she's known in Chinese, she was a journalist. She first became interested in the issue of sexual harassment and sexual abuse back in 2016 when she was a young journalist. And she came across a case at her alma mater, the university that she had once attended, where a student had accused a professor of sexual harassment. And the conversation online about that case all blamed the student. What was she wearing? What had she done to provoke the professor? And this infuriated Sophia Huang. And she started talking to her friends, fellow journalists, about the issue. She then discovered that they, too, had suffered a lot of sexual harassment. And so she became writing about this issue. She conducted a massive survey across China of female journalists working in newsrooms across China. And she uncovered that more than 80% of women working in Chinese newsrooms, at Chinese news organizations, had suffered sexual harassment. And so this is what really got her involved in the issue. But it is something that the Chinese authorities did not want her to continually speak out about.
And they have alleged that she has undermined China. How's that been received?
Well, China doesn't have a lot of abilities for freedom of expression. So we haven't had a lot of reaction to this, although within the small community, the activist community that she's been involved in, there's been a lot of dismay. You know, after Sophia Huang and her friend, we should say, was also tried, Wang Jianbing, he was a workers' rights activist, he was tried alongside her. You know, after the two were detained back in 2021, 70 of their friends were interrogated by police. Many were told to leave the city where they were all living. And that really seems to be the issue, that those two were getting together with groups of their friends and were all talking about ways that they could improve Chinese society. And it happened outside of the Communist Party. And that's why I think that those two were targeted alongside their friends.
Where does this leave the wider Me Too movement in China?
Well, the Me Too movement is really struggling in China. I mean, the Chinese authorities have never really encouraged it. Sophia Huang is not the first Chinese feminist who has been detained, who has faced prison time. You know, the Chinese authorities, we have to note that at the very top of the Chinese Communist Party, there are no women. And the men at the top of the party have long maintained their ability to say what happens in Chinese women's lives, whether they have children, how many children they have. And so even though they're loosening those policies, they're not stepping out of women's lives. And so that's why the Me Too movement, the feminist movement, even speaking out against domestic violence, really has not had a lot of space within the party. And since the party wants to take up all the space for conversation and action within China, it's very, very difficult for Chinese feminists to move forward.
Our Asia Pacific editor, Celia Hatton. Coming up on the Global News Podcast.
If I have the chance of make the Pope laugh, why won't I go? It was my most important gig. I performed for a spot in heaven.
How many comedians does it take to make the Pope laugh? The fallout of the conflict in the Middle East is being felt in unexpected places, music festivals being the latest battleground. Here in the UK, Barclays has suspended sponsorship of all Live Nation festivals this year, including Download, Latitude and the Isle of Wight, after protests from bands and fans over the bank providing financial services to defence companies supplying Israel. Will Chalk is at the Download Festival and told me more about the background to their decision.
Starting earlier this week, we had bands from the US, the UK and Australia pulling out of the festival, saying they disagreed with its ties with Barclays Bank. However, they were, with no disrespect intended to them, on some of those smaller stages. And it's only in the last 24 hours we've had a main stage act enter Shikari. They're a UK-based metal band. They're playing prime time tomorrow on the main stage. And they tweeted and put out on their Instagram that they were also in discussions with the festival about what they were going to do. And I think this made it a lot harder for Download and Barclaycard to kind of sweep this under the rug and ignore it. They had to do something. So it's only in the last few hours we've had this announcement from Barclays. Raoul Reynolds, he's the lead singer from Enter Shikari, who I mentioned earlier. He has just, in fact, sent me this voice note.
We've been considering our options on this for a while. We'd spoken to Download and expressed our objection at Barclays' involvement in the festival, given their ties to Israeli weapons manufacturers. Barclays needs to divest immediately. So it was obvious for us, you know, until that happens, Barclays has no place at any UK music festival.
So from Barclays' point of view, are they just saying we don't want to ruin the festival by risking more bands pulling out?
Yeah, from their perspective, they say they have been pressured into doing something that they simply don't want to do. They talk about the protesters having an agenda for Barclays to debank defence companies, which they say is something they remain committed to supporting the defence sector. They say it's an important part of keeping this country, the UK and our allies safe. They've accused people who support this campaign of intimidating their staff, vandalising their branches and online harassment. They conclude saying the only thing this small group of activists will achieve is to weaken essential support for cultural events enjoyed by millions.
And on the ground, do fans know this has happened? Is anyone bothered about it?
So I've been really surprised by this. You know, people come to festivals by and large to forget about the world outside and to have a good time. But I popped out into the crowd earlier and everyone I spoke to and said, oh, I'm from the BBC. I'd like to talk to you about the Barclays thing. Everyone knew what I was talking about and they all had an opinion too.
We shouldn't be supporting genocide, basically, until they started dropping out. I didn't know of Barclaycard's kind of involvement in it. So it's good they have brought to kind of everyone's attention what they're doing. So I suppose it does work by, you know, dropping out, putting pressure on them, that it does work.
So from the punters' perspectives then, this is kind of good to go for the rest of the weekend. They know they're going to see all of the bands that they have paid their money to see, other than the few who dropped out earlier in the week. But it's clear that this dispute between Barclays and sections of the music industry, well, this is clearly far from over.
Will Chalk reporting. Pope Francis has hosted more than 100 comedians from around the world, telling them that in difficult times they have the power to spread peace and smiles. Some commentators have said this meeting is partly an attempt to repair the Pope's image after he used a homophobic slur 2 weeks ago, for which the Vatican has apologised. Our religion editor Ali Makbul has more.
It's okay to laugh at God, in the same way we joke about the people we love. So said Pope Francis today at the Vatican. He was speaking to an audience of more than 100 comedians from around the world that included the co-creator of The Office, Stephen Merchant, Father Ted's Ardal O'Hanlon and Patrick Keelty. It's part of an attempt to engage with prominent names in contemporary culture and included a tribute to the comics.
Quando voi...
When you manage to make smiles gush from the lips of even one spectator, said the Pope, you make even God smile. Amid so much gloomy news, immersed as we are in so many tragedies, you have the power to spread serenity and smiles. After the speech, all the comedians, including Whoopi Goldberg, whose character in Sister Act disguised herself as a nun, lined up for a brief handshake and greeting.
Very fast and really loving and made me happy.
Given his recent missteps, it was probably just as well the Pope did all the talking today. The likes of Jimmy Fallon, Stephen Colbert and Chris Rock might have had something to say about the fact he's now reported on two separate occasions behind closed doors to have used homophobic slurs. In his speech today, he did say Sarah, the wife of Abraham, was nosy in the way women were, but on the other hand stressed that humour should not offend, humiliate or put down people.
My colleague Paul Henley spoke to one of the comedians who had an audience with the Pope. He's Michael Mittermeier, a mainstream comedy star of German TV and the stand-up circuit. He described how he made the Pope laugh.
I gave him a soccer jersey from the German team, the new one, the pink one. There's also the metaphor like pink, you know, he said something against gays and stuff. But on the back of the jersey, I had his name, Franciscus, and the number 10. I told him it's the 10 of Maradona. He's Argentinian, so Maradona is like a soccer god to him. And then I said to him, yeah, it's not only the 10 from Maradona, it's also the 10 commandments. It made him laugh.
If this was an attempt by the Vatican, by the Pope, to repair some of the damage done by his allegedly using this homophobic slur recently, do you think it will have helped? Will it have done the trick?
I don't know whether humour cannot change political attitude. It's always a matter of time. You know, all this stuff about that they cannot deal with humankind, like with gay people, trans people and this stuff, it takes a lot of time. I'm not excusing their slurs and what they say about people out there. But I'm always open for, let's do a small step. If I have the chance of make the Pope laugh, why won't I go? It was my most important gig. I performed for a spot in heaven.
Pacific grey whales are rapidly getting smaller, according to researchers in the US and Scotland who've been looking at data and drone measurements. The researchers found the average length of an adult is now 13% less than it was in the year 2000. Terry Egan reports.
Pacific grey whales are viewed as what's called ecosystem sentinels. Skinnier than other whales and less tough, they can give warning of possible health hazards from the ocean environment. Now it appears that over the last few decades, they've been shrinking in size. The researchers looked at data and drone images for 130 of the whales and measured a reduction of 13% from those born in 2000 to those born in 2020. It means a whale 14 metres long is at least a metre and a half shorter than it would have been in the past. And, even more noticeable, is that female whales, which are usually larger than the males, have shrunk to nearly the same size as them. Dr. Enrico Pirotta led the study.
Body size in animals is critical for many aspects of their biology and ecology. So it affects their physiology, but importantly for females, it affects their ability to store energy reserves and therefore to reproduce successfully. So that's the most important aspects that we're worried about, is the ability of females to produce a calf.
Over the same period of time in which the whales have been downsizing, climate change has disrupted ocean cycles. That's affecting the currents that help plankton to grow, and plankton is the whale's main source of food. The researchers say that disruption from climate change, both to their nutrition and environment, is probably the reason Pacific grey whales are shrinking. In the past, whale hunting meant these huge mammals, once vilified as devilfish, came near to extinction. Now, they appear to be facing a new type of danger altogether.
Now, from some of the world's largest mammals to some of the smallest. Have you ever heard of mouse jigglers? Not toys for cats, but an ingenious way of convincing a computer you're busy working even if you're away from the screen. Some employees are using the devices to get around productivity tracking software to pretend they're at their desks while working from home, even if they're not. It seems employers are wising up to this. The American bank Wells Fargo has sacked several staff members after claims they were using mouse jigglers to try and trick their bosses. How do they work? Well, Carl Howell designs and produces them in the UK.
My variation is a 3D printed piece of plastic, all recycled, I'll add. And then there's a watch inside with a second hand that stimulates the mouse every minute. It's a standalone device, and you literally just put your normally wired mouse on top of what is my device, and then all of a sudden position it correctly, and you're good to go and carry on reading the documentation or go to the restroom. It can keep the mouse moving for as long as it's needed. Always jiggle responsively is the key messaging. There's a lot of horrible bosses out there, and more than you think, trying to micromanage everybody's action. They're the actual problem in the company. It's not the worker who's going, you know, I've actually done my day's quota. So there does need to be a culture change, and it's from the bosses, and it's from, like it or not, it's the older people who have been established too long, who haven't been paying attention to the temperature of what's going on in the workplace.
Big firms have been getting tougher on hybrid workers of late. Here's our North America business correspondent, Michelle Fleury.
With the rise of remote working since the pandemic, some large companies have been using increasingly sophisticated tools to monitor employees. There is technology that can track keystrokes and which websites workers have visited. But methods for evading surveillance have also evolved. Mouse movers or mouse jigglers are devices that simulate mouse movement to stop a computer from going to sleep and make it look like the user is working. Wells Fargo adopted a hybrid working model in 2022, with staff permitted to work from home some of the time. It's now sacked a number of people employed in its wealth and investment management unit for pretending to be at their keyboards. The BBC has confirmed 6 instances in which staff were dismissed, and one case in which a person resigned voluntarily after being confronted with the claims. The bank said it did not tolerate unethical behaviour. It's not yet clear how the issue was discovered.
Our North America business correspondent, Michelle Fleury. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this podcast, the email address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or you'll find us on X, where we are at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by James Piper. The producer was Isabella Jewell. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
What stories would you like to share with your daughter? What does she need to know to help her navigate her life ahead? Dear Daughter is the award-winning podcast from the BBC World Service, full of thoughtful letters of advice, personal stories, and life lessons for daughters everywhere. You can catch up with the whole series now by searching for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter.